Hello, I'm ISS Head of Special Situations Research, Cristiano Guerra. Welcome to this proxy bulletin focusing on the hugely significant and high-profile proxy fight at ExxonMobil on May 26th. Since late 2020, we have seen a lot of activity in the energy sector, including the mergers of Noble and Chevron, WPX and Devon, Parsley and Pioneer, and Concho and ConocoPhillips, to name a few. Much of this has been driven by institutional shareholders who, after years of poor TSR and concerns about the long-term future of the sector, have clearly articulated their expectation that energy companies shift their focus from production to free cash flow and a return of capital. At the same time, interest in renewables has soared as investors have become increasingly attentive to sustainability concerns and opportunities. The confluence of these forces created the ideal backdrop for a campaign in the energy space that incorporated ESG issues as a central theme. And so we find ourselves with what is easily the most interesting proxy fight of this season, engine number one seeking four of the 12 seats on the board of ExxonMobil. Over the next few minutes, I'll be breaking down this fight with three members of the Special Situations Research Team, Heath Winter, Nina Icardi, and Andrew Bork. Heath, we'll start with you. In just about every proxy contest, both sides tend to cherry pick the data. The dissident presents an argument that the company has underperformed, while the company is able to slice the data in a way that tells the opposite story. Was that the case here as well?
Well, so there are two basic sets of inputs into evaluating total shareholder return. First, what are the appropriate peers to use for comparison? And second, what is the relevant timeframe for assessing the performance? There was substantially and surprisingly less cherry-picking around the peer set in this contest compared to other campaigns, perhaps because of Exxon's prominence due to both its size and its storied history. There appears to be consensus between both sides that Exxon's performance should be compared against four other oil supermajors: Chevron, Shell, Total, and BP. The timeframes suggested by engine number one and Exxon, on the other hand, showed a little more artifice. While the dissidents' materials evaluated the company's total share return over 1, 3, 5, and 10-year periods, ending either on the December 2020 date when their campaign became public, or the February 2020 date marked by a sharp market pullback due to the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. When we spoke with them, we were told that the timeframe actually didn't matter, that the company has underperformed its peers regardless of which time period is used. The company, however, recommended using the 6-month, 1-year, 2-year, or 3-year periods for TSR evaluation and suggested that the end date for the time period should be April 15th, 2021. Remember, the dissident thought the time frame should end in either February 2020 pre-COVID or December 2020 pre-contest. The company's argument was that Exxon transitioned from a period of investment, reorganization, and low demand between 2016 and 2018 to one of development of acquired assets and reduced TSR underperformance, that is, they closed the gap with peers, from 2018 to 2020. Since April 2020, the company suggested, Exxon shares outperformed due to good operational execution. The argument that total share return should be evaluated since April 2020 and through April 2021 may have been cherry picking.
Right, but in the last few months, Exxon shares have rallied. Year to date, they're up more than 40%. Based on our findings, what seems to be the main reason for the company's improved performance in recent months?
So because of substantial recent volatility shocks to the energy market, the notion that recent share performance is more relevant for this analysis makes a lot of sense. If you think about it, the recent action of shares in the current oil price environment, as the effects of the pandemic recede, are going to tell you a lot more about the quality of operations and management than a medium or long-term look at the 5 or 10-year return would. It was April 2020 when Brent crude hit its lowest price in decades. Exxon may have had strong operational execution since then, but it seems likely that a good amount of the positive total share return since April 20 is due to the recovery in oil prices and the company's continued exposure to oil.
And Heath, how about the dissidents' involvement? Did engine number one's public campaign have an impact on shareholder returns?
So there are a few recurring arguments that we hear from dissidents to demonstrate that their involvement has had a positive impact. Sometimes the dissident will assert that its involvement alone prompted a company to be more responsive to the issues the dissident has identified. In this case, engine number one believes that Exxon has moved more quickly and been more communicative about its plans to address climate change and capital allocation than the company otherwise would have. One counterpoint, though, is that engine number one was not the only shareholder actively pushing to make the company to make changes. For example, D.E. Shaw also made a public statement regarding the need for change at the company in December 2020, the same week that engine number one launched its campaign. It's a very brief time frame for assessment, but we can see that in the week ending on December 11, 2020, XOM shares rose 5.8% more than the median of its peers on trading volume that was approximately 28% higher than the prior year's median volume. Our recommendation was certainly not determined by the investment return of a single week, but this is an interesting data point to evaluate the market's reflexive reaction to the dissident's concerns.
Great, thanks, Heath. Let's turn now to the operational side of things. Nina, before this fight, when Exxon was mentioned, I would think of two things, oil and dividends. Now, Exxon has historically treated its dividend as something sacred. What role did the dividend play in this contest?
Sure. So Exxon features a four-page brochure on its investor relations website, which highlights dividends, warrants, and distributions paid to shareholders since 1911, and shows that the company has paid a dividend every single year for over 100 years. Having such a brochure speaks to the importance that the dividend has played in Exxon's investment case. During this proxy contest, each side accused the other of putting the dividend at risk. The company's proxy materials feature statements like, "Don't let engine number one derail our progress and jeopardize your dividend and investment." In turn, the dissident in his materials points out that such rhetoric is, quote, "particularly notable given that debt finance spending on low return projects has created the real threat to the dividend," unquote. Our research and analysis concluded that although Exxon's message about its commitment to the dividend has been consistent, shareholders are justified in having concerns about the dividend's consistent growth and reliability under the current strategy. Based on our analysis, the average annual growth rate of the dividend slowed down to 4% since the appointment of Woods as CEO in late 2016. For 15 years prior to his appointment, the average annual dividend growth was 8%. More importantly, since the company embarked on its investment program in 2017, its cash flows have not been sufficient to cover the capital expenditures and the dividend. As a result, Exxon has taken on over $25 billion in incremental debt. If the company misses its current cash flow projections going forward and fails to adjust its investment program, the reliability of the dividend may indeed be compromised as the company is close to reaching its own stated debt limit.
And what other aspects of the dissident's critique of operational performance did we find particularly compelling?
One of dissident's key arguments is that due to Exxon's focus on production growth, the company has not been disciplined in its capital allocation strategy. The dissident charges that Exxon has pursued the most aggressive spending plans in the industry despite investor demand for capital discipline. Our review of the company's communications to the market since the investment program launched in 2017, the company's projections, and the analysis of actual reported results suggest that a lack of capital allocation discipline resulted in a worsening financial condition, loss of investor confidence, and share price underperformance. Shortly after Woods was appointed as CEO in late 2016, Exxon embarked on a transformational investment program. The company argued that unlike many of its competitors, it had an opportunity to make countercyclical investments that would position it for strong returns by 2025. Despite repeated assurances that it would be able to fund the investment program through cash flow while maintaining its attractive dividend and strong balance sheet, Exxon missed cash flow projections every year from the launch of the investment program through the onset of the pandemic. This has translated into a cumulative cash flow deficit of nearly $20 billion and incremental debt of over $25 billion. We believe that Exxon's continuous investments, despite its deteriorating financial condition, has damaged the company's credibility with investors. At the inception of the investment program in 2017, Exxon indicated that it would exercise flexibility and adjust with the business environment. Yet there was no evidence of investment flexibility prior to the pandemic. Exxon only made short-term adjustments to its capital investments in response to a severe cash flow decline in 2020, but continues to guide to significant capital investment through 2025.
Thanks, Nina. Now, as we mentioned before, what really makes this contest unique is the fact that ESG arguments, especially climate change and energy transition, are not just tangential concerns, but a central theme to this campaign. In order to thoroughly evaluate these issues, the SSR team was able to leverage ISS's deep expertise in this area and collaborate with our ESG colleagues here in the US as well as in Europe. Andrew, prior to joining the SSR team, you spent some time as an analyst looking at all ESG aspects, so you were well positioned to evaluate these arguments. How would you summarize the dissidents' critique, and what has been the company's response to this issue?
Thank you, Cristiano. So Exxon accepts that lower carbon sources of energy will play an increasingly important role moving forward. And the company also recognizes that it is going to need to evolve and it's going to need to adapt to these changes. So it's created a strategy to do so. The strategy is constructed around assumptions. There are assumptions about demand, about timing, assumptions about technology. And the dissident is arguing that Exxon's strategy, its plan for navigating an energy transition, is just built on an unrealistic set or collection of these assumptions, which has created a risk to the business itself. So Exxon is, of course, pushing back on that argument, and the company has also drawn attention to its track record and other recent developments. So, for instance, Exxon rolled out its low-carbon solutions business in February, and one of its two stated priorities for maximizing shareholder value is actually investing in low-carbon, longer-term opportunities. So the company is effectively saying that it's putting its money where its mouth is. One of the most important aspects of Exxon's strategy, and one that's really wrapped up in or that underpins the low-carbon solutions business in particular, is carbon capture. Exxon has extensive experience in this area, and the technology is being positioned by the company as a way for it to continue capitalizing on the demand for fossil fuels that is expected to persist into the foreseeable future, despite progressively declining.
So, spoiler alert for those clients who may not have read a report yet, but we concluded that the dissident made a compelling case for change and recommended in favor of three of the four dissident nominees. Andrew, let's talk about how we got to that number. How much did the climate change and energy transition argument have to do with it?
Sure. So I think it's important to understand at the outset that the dissident's case is built on two fundamentally separate but related arguments. So as I discussed a moment ago, there's this ESG argument that's centered on climate change, but there's also a more conventional or a more recognizable argument that's centered on operational performance. So if we separate these arguments and we focus just on the operational critique, it's clear that change is warranted. And this need for change has effectively been recognized by Exxon and that the company's refreshed the board. The result of this refreshment has been somewhat of a mixed bag. On one hand, the board's capital allocation expertise has in fact been bolstered by the addition of Michael Angelakis and Jeff Ubben. As Nina mentioned, this is a core concern for the company from an operational standpoint. So these are positive additions. But on the other hand, the board still lacks a relevant industry perspective. Angelakis and Ubben, they're not energy sector veterans. And for years, really, before this contest, the only person with deep energy sector experience on the board was Darren Woods, the chairman and CEO. It's also worth pointing out that the board added the former CEO of Petronas, Juan Zulkifli, but he had a prior relationship with management, and the circumstances just call for unassailable independence. So Exxon, it does deserve a degree of credit for recent changes, but there are still lingering deficiencies, and that's how we got to two. Now, if we move back to the climate change and the energy transition argument, the dissident has also made a substantive and a compelling case here. So at surface level, the company does appear to be taking this seriously, but if you dig just a bit deeper, there are actually questions about how committed it is. And shareholders, they also just don't have enough information at this point to develop a fully informed opinion about the company's energy transition strategy. So we see questions about commitment. We see a disconnect, really, between the apparent importance of this area and the extent to which relevant experience is making its way to the board or is reflected in board composition. And we see insufficient disclosure. So one of the nominees that we recommended supporting on the basis of operational performance, Kaisa Hietala, she could contribute here as well, but it's just not enough. And that's how we got to one on this argument. So the key takeaway here is that we recommended support for two of the dissident nominees on the basis of fundamental operational performance and one dissident nominee on the basis of the energy transition argument.
Got it. Andrew, you mentioned Kaisa Hietala. Let's talk a little bit about the nominees themselves.
Sure. So we recommended support for Gregory Goff and Kaisa Hietala on the basis of operational performance. As I mentioned, despite the recent board refreshment, the board still does not have the unquestionably independent and relevant industry perspective that quite frankly it needs. And this is a deficiency that both of the dissident nominees can address. Goff has decades of energy industry experience. He served in a variety of positions at public oil and gas companies in both the United States and abroad. And Hietala, likewise, she has extensive industry experience, and she's actually played a leading role in the development and execution of a major public oil and gas company's energy transition strategy. And just as importantly, both are unquestionably independent. And as I mentioned, this is a paramount consideration. So moving on, we recommended support for Alexander Karsner on the basis of the energy transition argument. And this is a role that he just seems to be particularly well suited for. And I say that because Exxon's strategy here, it relies heavily on carbon capture. And the viability of carbon capture appears to depend in a significant way on government support. And Karsner has a background in energy policy. So he should be able to assist the board in remaining ahead of developments. And he should actually also ensure that internal discussion around broader energy transition points is moving in the right direction. As I mentioned, Hietala, she can also contribute here. She has that energy transition experience, but I do think it's important to remember that we supported her first and foremost on the basis of the company's operational performance. I think it's also important to mention that we have no specific concerns with the fourth nominee, with Anders Runevad, nor do we have any specific reason to believe that he could not or indeed that he would not be an effective director. And there are some shareholders that may want to support him. We are simply taking the least invasive approach here, as we always do. And we believe that in combination with the directors recently added by the company itself, two dissident directors are sufficient to address the operational concerns. And we believe that one additional dissident director is warranted to address the energy transition concerns. And we think that Goff, Hietala, and Karsner are the three best suited to these tasks.
Thanks, Andrew, Nina, and Heath. That was an excellent summary of the key points of our analysis. This has easily been one of the most interesting and meaningful contests that we've had the privilege to work on. So to our listeners, thank you. We hope you found this podcast helpful and interesting. Please watch your emails over the course of the coming weeks for information on and links to other episodes of this season's podcast series. From all of us at ISS, thanks again for listening. Goodbye for now, and stay safe.